What's the difference between DIY and doing it yourself? It's the difference between a part-time passion and a full-time business. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker with a website that fits your unique vision and the business tools you need to succeed. Let your ideas flow with AI that guides you but keeps you in the driver's seat. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Do it yourself. Go to Wix.com.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, as always. Really interesting show for you this week. And we talk on Future Proof about the promise of the future. And this is one that is actually really close. It's mining plastic and rocks for food. Yes, you heard that right. We're going to be hearing from a researcher in Western University in Ontario about this extraordinary work. One more thing before we get into the science news, and that is that I am running AI skills boot camps for people who are busy and want to get on top of their to-do list. If you're interested in learning these skills of the future, you can do so by logging on to getstartedai.com. There's a boot camp in Dublin on the 11th of March, really, really soon. Book at getstartedai.com. All right, it's time to look back at the week's science news. We're joined by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield of the University of Galway and Dr. Tara Shine, environmental scientist and CEO of Change by Degrees. We're going to start off, Jess, talking about a current. And we've spoken a bit about the AMOC, which is right beside Ireland in the Atlantic, and whether or not that's slowing down looks like it's not as terrifying as some of the headlines have said. But this is to do with a totally different current in the Antarctic.
That's right. This is about the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. And this is basically a huge current that just goes all the way around Antarctica. It's the separation between the rest of the oceans and the Southern Ocean. And it's circumpolar. It goes all the way around. And it's actually incredibly strong. Like, it's 5 times stronger than the Gulf Stream. It's more than 100 times stronger than the Amazon River. And what it does is basically keeps the Southern Ocean separate from other big oceans in the world. So the Southern Ocean, obviously, it's around Antarctica, so it's much colder. But it's incredibly diverse, huge biodiversity. And that's why lots of big marine animals from all over the world go down to Antarctica in the summer, like feed there, and then go back up into polar or warmer waters in the equatorial times of the year. So basically this current, which is separating the Southern Ocean from the rest of the planet, that makes it a little bit more resistant to global warming. However, there's new simulations coming out of the University of Melbourne that show that as water from the Antarctic ice sheets is melting, that's actually very likely to slow the current down. And so that will then let more of this warm, salty water into the Southern Ocean, melt those ice sheets further. You get kind of a feedback loop, which is potentially really not great for Antarctica. Now, you know, the question is always like, we're not in Antarctica. Does this matter to us? And the thing that makes it matter is actually this interconnection of food webs all over the world. So the Antarctic krill, which is this really small little shrimp looking dude. I was just back from Antarctica like 3 weeks ago, and we managed to see some Antarctic krill when we were visiting Palmer Station, which is one of the U.S. bases there. It just looks like a little like thumb sized shrimp, like very small, very clear, not like as thick or swole as a shrimp, but just like a little tiny guy. But the Southern Ocean is absolutely full of them. And so these krill are supporting food chains that bring down, you know, humpback whales, orcas, all of these really big, big marine mammals that then go off into other parts of the ocean system and do other things. So the collapse of this Antarctic circumpolar current would be potentially really bad for those krill. It would be really bad for basically the last semi-pristine ocean that we have. And it's going to be interesting to see as the simulations that are used for this get better and better, can we see any way out of it? Because this research is from the University of Melbourne. It includes new parts of the simulation of these circumpolar currents, which are kind of difficult to simulate. You have to take eddies and all these like little interactions of the sea into account. But it's good to know that, you know, this is yet another reason why we don't want to lose our ice caps, basically.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, I suppose, that bit by bit, there's nothing we can do about this individual thing. We can't, there's no preventative measure, because we're talking about enormous bodies of water. We can't put a fence up, or, you know, influence mm-hmm. this enormous amount of krill, or influence migration patterns, or this movement of nutrients across the oceans. Like, that's none of them yeah. none of those,
like,
interventions can we
connected.
Do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think sometimes when we think about these like impacts from climate change, we think, oh, that's happening very far away. It doesn't matter to me, maybe. Like, that's too bad for like whales at Antarctica, but like, I'm not a whale in Antarctica. But it's like, no, it's all connected. And so we absolutely have to, you know, focus on the things that we can do something about, like our emissions, because this is one of the many, many things that will be impacted by continued inaction.
Yeah. So look, I mean, it's the same message, just a different messenger. Tara, our second story has to do with tattoos.
Yes, tattoos. So I'm always staggered by how many people now have tattoos. So I just looked this up. Apparently 35% of Irish adults have tattoos.
Wow.
So like, I don't know. I am definitely in the minority, don't have one.
35%? But hang on. What about like, there's lots of people who are like 10 and under and 65
adults,
and older.
Oh, adults.
Oh, okay, adults. Okay. But even adults, yeah. We're talking about people who are 65 plus. So like, that is a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. Yeah. And in the US, and the UK, it's about the same, like quarter to a third of adults. Yeah. So and it's been a huge rise in the last few, like in the last decade. It's really become a very socially acceptable, if not desirable, thing to do. Mm. Personally, I could never decide what I was, you know, in love with enough to write it on myself that I'd still want it written there when I was 90. So then never did it. But anyway, but yeah, can tattoos give you cancer is the question. There was an initial study done in a Swedish university back in 2024 that made a connection. And then out this week is a new study from the University of South Denmark, which looked at 5,900 twins in Denmark.
Wow.
And surveyed them to collect data on any kinds of associations between tattoos and cancer. And it was really interesting doing it on sets of twins, because that meant they could separate out the genetic factors from the environmental factors. And basically they found that the bigger your tattoo and the longer you have it, the higher the risks of lymphoma. So yeah, and by quite a lot. So the bigger tattoo, the longer you have it, it can be up to 3 times greater risk of getting lymphoma. And that's because, this is interesting, I think, it's because when you get tattooed, the ink, sometimes they're carcinogenic ink, sometimes they're very organic, but that ink is seen by your body as an alien substance. And so your immune system kicks in. Also, quite quickly, those ink particles move up into the lymph nodes and stay there. And then they're kind of constantly triggering a reaction, which then affects the cells, which can make them change into cancer cells. So, yeah, it's another thing to think about if you're going for tattoos, and maybe something to slightly worry about if you're someone who has a lot of their body covered in tattoos.
Yeah, I mean, I always have David Spiegelhalter, the great British statistician and science communication expert, in my head when we talk about statistics. And one of those, the classic statistics was something like, you know, if you, there was a new newspaper article that says drinking 5 cups of tea will, you know, triple your rate of getting cancer. But of course, it was a certain type of cancer, and that cancer was very, very rare. And so lymphoma obviously is not a very common cancer, but it's not very rare, right? I mean, a tripling of the likelihood of that. That would certainly cause me to pause. But it's
for
it's,
larger, yeah, for larger tattoos, so larger than the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
Now they do say in the study, they say, look, this, you know, there was research done in 2024. Here's more in 2025. More work is needed, but the initial indications are that there's something more to study there for certain.
Yeah, and then you probably need, you know, if you know, you do need to think about the practice. You know, understand it a bit more. And do you know what? For me, I'm really surprised we didn't know this sooner. I mean, how did we not look at these links? Now, it is a correlational study. 5,000 is quite a lot of people, and that's quite a significant effect. So I would take this, you know, I would think about this, really, if I was thinking about getting a tattoo myself. But as you say, yeah, more research is required.
And there's lots of other studies. If you go back in time, there's more studies like looking at impacts on different kinds of bacterial infections. There's research on links to melanoma, which doesn't seem, couldn't find anything definitive there, but also like to blood related diseases. So that we've been more aware of. And I think sort of greater standardization of tattoo practices and, you know, like greater focuses on kind of like it's like a medical intervention rather than, you know, getting your ears pierced kind of thing.
Yeah.
Definitely things to think about.
Yeah, thanks, Tara. Okay, our third story is a fun one, Jess. It's got to do with enhancing our digital experiences.
Yeah, so I mean, there's all these new developments in VR coming out. They're really amazing. The experience has really gotten so much better in recent years. But
you sound so enthusiastic about them.
the problem, there's a huge problem, which is that if you're in a virtual reality, you know, simulation and you lick a rock, it doesn't taste like anything. And to me, that's not acceptable. However, researchers from The Ohio State University in the U.S. have developed a new e-taste device, which allows you to have tastes added to your virtual reality experience. I really feel like this is what was missing. And the thing is, the reason why it hasn't been done before, right, is that it's actually very hard to simulate taste.
Yeah.
So, you know, previous approaches that people tried were like putting electrodes on the tongue, trying to simulate different taste buds. That like works a little bit, but it doesn't make a taste like a food or anything. It only captures a few kinds of taste. And of course, smell is a big piece of taste as well. The sensory system is just really complicated. But this e-taste device actually takes a new approach. So it has two parts. Basically, the first part of it is a sensing platform. So they call it an electronic tongue that lets you take like a liquidized sample of a food or drink. It looks at the concentration of five different taste chemicals in it, a sweet one, a sour one, a salty one, a bitter one, and an umami, you know, savory one. And then it sends this information wirelessly to a second part of the e-taste platform. And this device basically like takes those concentrations and it has gels and five different of those edible taste chemicals, delivers them to an outlet that is in your mouth so that you also have the taste. So you can send your taste to a friend and the taste chemicals that they use. Listeners, you can't see Jonathan's face, but it is not happy about this.
No, I am recoiling with horror at this idea. So wait, what gets put into your mouth? Is it electrical stimulation or is it a goo?
No, it's a goo. So the things that they use, they have glucose, which is sweet. They have citric acid, which is sour. They have, you know, sodium chloride, so salty. Magnesium chloride is kind of bitter. And then glutamate is the umami, kind of savory one. And what I really love about this is that they did a test. They did a bunch of tests with participants, you know, to try to see how well the platform's idea of what something tasted like matched to the actual thing. And with human subjects, the things that they tried to replicate were the taste of lemonade, cake, fried egg, coffee, and fish soup. So human subjects, the lemonade and cake actually worked pretty well. I think that the sweet flavors were a bit easier to replicate and to identify and be like, oh yeah, that's that thing. But like the one that was the worst in terms of like matching taste to the participant experience was a fried egg. And I even like, how do you describe what a fried egg tastes like?
No, it's very, very difficult.
Can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I would want taste delivered to my mouth in this way. Like it's sort of, it takes like the VR experience and it makes it a lot more intrusive.
Yeah. No, there's something very intrusive about this. And also, why not just eat some cake? I think sometimes we over-engineer our experiences a little bit. Like if you're playing in a game, why don't they just send you a bit of cake in the box with the CD for the game? And then you play the game. They don't use the CDs anymore, but the download package, in the post, they send you like a slice of cake and you eat the cake while playing the game. It seems like an easier solution to me.
Well, and even like if you want to send your cake to a friend, just give them their own cake. Like don't try to e-send them your taste. I think they can have their own cake.
Indeed. Finally, Tara, and we won't spend too much time on this one because we have talked about sort of, you know, bringing back the woolly mammoth quite a bit on this program, but we are one step closer whether or not it's a good idea. We have woolly mice. What's going on?
We have woolly mice. Yes, we have woolly mice. I love the name of this company. It's a US company called Colossal Biosciences. Isn't that a great name?
Yeah.
And they are taking their first steps towards woolly mammoths, woolly elephants even. They think they're going to have woolly elephants by 2028. They think they're going to have an embryo by 2026. But at the moment, they're at the mouse stage of things. So basically, they've made a really cute, really hairy mouse. And that's kind of all, that's really all they have to say right now, but they're trying to make it sound a little bit more exciting than that. So they've taken a mouse and they've modified 8 of its genes. 7 of those genes are just giving it the better hair. So it really is looking great when you see the photos of it. And one of them is from a woolly mammoth. And that's about helping the mouse to lay down more fat. Because obviously if the aim ultimately is to do genome sequencing with Asian elephants to give them more fat and more hair so that they can withstand long periods of time at minus 40 degrees living up in the Arctic. That's where they're trying to get at. And so, but they're really at a very early stage. So they've managed to get lots of hair growing. They haven't done so well on the fat reserves on the mouse. And obviously there's a lot of questions about this. Is this just a whole, you know, a lot of nonsense? Is it ethical? In reading around about, you know, what they're trying to do, ultimately they're trying to make mammoths so they can put mammoths back in the Arctic so that we introduce large herbivores back into the Arctic who are going to knock down trees and graze the land and kind of restore it to a grassland habitat rather than the shrubby woody habitat that's there now, in the hope that that will allow the permafrost to have a better chance of staying frozen. But you know, we already have indigenous people up there with reindeer, we already have bison. I'm not certain we need to go to the extent of, you know, re-engineering a mammoth. But anyway, they're very excited because they're at the mouse stage.
It seems to me that this is not a great scientific achievement. It also appears to me that there are only a very small number of people in the world who think that, A, we need to bring back the mammoth, or B, we should bring back the mammoth. I don't know. This just seems ridiculous in lots of different ways. But like making a mouse more hairy gets you a headline and gets you talking about it on a radio show, as we've seen. You can see photographs of these woolly mice, who are literally nothing much more than that, on our Twitter page. We're at News Talk Science. Tara Schein and Jessamyn Fairfield, thanks very much. You might think that when you've finished with plastic, that's just it. You throw it in the bin. But my next guest has been turning it into edible food that could be ingested by astronauts in the future. And his plans also include converting asteroids. Engineering professor Dr. Joshua Pierce is from Western University in Canada. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Joshua. This is an interesting area of work. What got you into trying to get food out of things that aren't food?
Thanks, Jonathan. It started off a long time ago when I was working with a collaborator, David Deckenberger, on trying to find solutions to world hunger in the event of extreme bad things happening. So let's say an asteroid running into the planet and making all conventional agriculture fail. And so we've been working on resilient foods now for roughly a decade. And as we've gone on to it more and more, we've kind of stepped away from more conventional things, like say producing mushrooms or seaweed that can be done in low light conditions, to actually converting other types of carbon into human edible food.
Why, out of interest, did you step away from mushrooms or even slightly more obvious, I would have thought, would be, you know, inedible plants, wood and so on? Because plastic seems to be a very unyielding, nutritionally and taste-wise, a very unyielding substance to try and get food from. Why did you turn away from those other substances?
So the mushrooms and seaweed and, growing algae or bacteria on normal organic matter is a good idea. And so if you live in an area with lots of trees, even with large scale loss of sunlight for many years, the trees will die, but you could still, say, harvest mushrooms on the wood. But in other circumstances, you might not have access to them. And so the first bit of work that we did looking at converting plastics into food was actually sponsored by the Department of Defense in the US. And they have this problem where you have soldiers that are out in the field, maybe they're doing a humanitarian mission, they're eating MREs, which come in these really nicely multi-plastic layer sealed bags, and they can't recycle them easily at all. In the olden days, they would throw them into burn pits, but that causes all kinds of other trouble. You don't want to leave them there and create a bunch of mess. And so they asked if there was a way that we could convert it into something the military would need. And so we found that we could convert it into both a gas that you could use combust for energy, oils that you'd use for lubricants, and most intriguingly, you could take some of that oil and feed it to a consortium of bacteria that you could then consume yourself. Like then you'd essentially be turning plastic first by breaking it down and then by building it back up in the bodies of bacteria that you could eat.
When you say bacteria you could eat, that's not, well, if I think of dinner time, that is not the first thing that comes into my head. Why is bacteria what we're interested in this process?
Yeah, so you actually probably eat bacteria at least a little bit. Like if you've ever had yogurt, you're familiar with eating bacteria. In this particular case, I teamed up with a professor, Steve Techman at Michigan Tech, who was an expert in bacteria that could eat oil. And so you probably heard about, you know, an oil spill and they bring in these biological agents that can consume the oil and kind of solve the problem. Those biological agents, some of them at least, can be eaten by humans. And so we put together kind of a team of different bacteria that would each work together in order to be able to make human edible food.
Right. Okay. So this is an interesting idea in I suppose, in theory. But in the practicality, when we're talking about essentially culturing bacteria for food, who is really going to do that? What does bacteria taste like? And are people, you know, from a psychosocial point of view, are people willing to eat bacteria as sustenance?
I think so. So I guess there's two ways you can look at this. One would be in an emergency situation. So if we did have some sort of global catastrophe where conventional agriculture failed, this is a way out where we could take our current almost unlimited supplies of waste plastic and convert it into human edible food. But in the military's case, it was also a distribution problem. And so if you're risking your life taking, say, another trip back to the base to your forward operating location just to bring lunch or dinner, it makes a lot more sense if you can be producing as much food as possible from the stores that you already have. And being that waste plastic is almost a ubiquitous resource throughout planet Earth, that gives you a way to produce food where you're at. And then that same process that we can use to produce food from plastic, we can also use for any kind of carbon-containing matter. And that's where the concept of using asteroids for food comes in. Because similar to plastics, you wouldn't normally think that you could eat asteroids. But it turns out that there are actually some asteroids with quite a bit of carbon in them. And we, at least in theory, can convert that carbon in the same way that we can plastics.
Right. I'm reading this book by the brilliant Mary Roach. I don't know if you've read it. In the opening chapter, she talks about a NASA Mars mission where they were trying to figure out how to do exactly what you're talking about. And the title of the paper is called Human Intolerance to Bacteria as Food. You know this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in it, I quote, she says, "Leaving aside the vomiting and vertigo that the subject felt, the 13 bowel movements in 12 hours from subject H would put off most people. Pale gray aerobacter was served as slurry." Is that sort of meal that people of the future might look forward to?
We can hope. So I can tell you right now, it's certainly premature to start chowing down on a bowl of it. We've done several things to make sure that it's safe. So first we did the chemical analysis of it and compared it to the European toxicology database, and it looked clean. Then we fed it to some worms that were, you know, very similar to humans in terms of DNA. And they preferred their normal food, but they'd eat it if they had to. and they were able to reproduce and seemed reasonably happy. And then we've done two mice studies so far.
No, wait. I can't let you get away with that one. You fed it to some worms that had human-like DNA and they seemed relatively happy. Can you just qualify that a little, please?
Yeah. So like whenever they were given a choice, they would take their normal food. But if you didn't give them a choice, they would eat it and then they were able to reproduce. And so that's kind of like the, I don't know, litmus test of if the food is good enough, if the species can kind of continue with only eating it.
Right. Okay.
It's much harder to get ethical approval to do that for humans. So you have to do it in these steps.
I'm sure it is. For sure. Is bacteria all we can make from something like this? From plastic? Is bacteria all we can make?
Well, so to make it slightly more palatable, and especially if you were doing this kind of, you know, in non-emergency or non-forward operating base type situations, you could feed the bacteria to something else, and say fish or chicken, and then eat the fish or chicken. And so it could be a very normal diet in the future if this is the direction that we go. But that said, we eat bacteria and food all the time, and the nutritional scientists are pretty good at making things taste like other things. And so in this particular step, where we are now is we've made sure that it doesn't acutely hurt mice. They were fine eating a little bit of it. And then we've tried kind of like a modest diet, so not a full 100% diet of it, but integrated it into their food supply, and they seem fine. So over the long term, having some of your calories come from it doesn't seem to cause any harm.
Where does bacteria fit on the food triangle?
That's a good question.
Presumably it has carbohydrates, right? But does it have anything else?
Yes. So actually when we originally planned this out, we were planning to make primarily protein powder, but it turns out that it's roughly a balanced meal. So it's kind of a third carbs, a third fat, and a third protein. And so one could in theory just eat that if you have supplements for your micronutrients.
Okay. But how energy intensive is it to turn plastics into bacteria for eating?
So the system that we built for the military was all solar powered. And so we did a field trial for a month in Michigan where we kind of went out into the middle of nowhere and had PV modules providing the electricity pumped into batteries that would then do the whole process. And the whole process is a little bit complicated in the case of plastics. So first, the plastic goes and is shredded into small pieces like confetti. Then it goes into a chemical reactor where it's broken down chemically into an oil-like substance.
Mmm, delicious.
Yeah, you don't want to touch that. That goes into the bioreactor for the consortia to eat. And then after they've eaten it, you can harvest them after they've grown and then dry that out. And that becomes your kind of meal powder, which you don't necessarily have to dry it all the way down. It could be more like a milkshake. If you dry it a little bit more, it's more like yogurt. If you dry it more than that, it's a powder, so you could add it to, I don't know, bread.
And so like, what sort of yield would you get from, say, a plastic meal wrapper? Would you get enough for a quarter of a meal, or?
No, it's not, well, let's say roughly a tenth. So you're losing some of it, of the breakdown products, like you're still creating some gases from the process. And we've been, so it's not super efficient. And if you look at the case of asteroids, we're talking about mining tons of asteroid material to produce enough food for a single asteroid or for a single astronaut. But the processes themselves.
Let's go to the asteroid in a second. But you were just saying a tenth of a meal. So when you're talking about asteroids, as far as I'm aware, do not have plastic. So what is the process by which you extract food from asteroids?
So asteroids do have carbon in them. And you can think of it almost like low-quality coal. And so we've made food from coal before using similar type processes. And we hypothesized that we could use the same process that we use for plastic to create food from these coal-like asteroids.
Right. And so take me through that, if you don't mind. So you can make food from coal how?
Yeah, so same idea. You're taking your what would be a solid rock and pounding it, grinding it into a fine powder that would have enough surface area for the bacteria to get to. And then depending on the state of matter that it's at, like how big the carbon chains are, the carbon clunk chunks, you'd either have to break them down with chemically again, or you could feed them directly to the bacteria.
Okay, so you still have, like a sourdough, you need like a starter culture, right? So you need a bunch of bacteria, but the idea is they will consume and reproduce at a very quick rate. And as a result, they will multiply, having eaten the carbon and grown and multiplied, and then you eat the bacteria, or you feed the bacteria to something else. That's the idea?
Exactly.
Well, that's great to hear. I'm still not sold on the concept, I got to be honest with you, Joshua. So in the future, the idea of using this in space, is the idea that you could land on a planet. And as long as you had your starter culture bacteria, you could just let it run loose on some rock for a few days and then come back and harvest what it has. I mean, like, surely if we're going to be thinking about this for space travel, we need to have an environment that bacteria can survive in. Do we know if your bacteria that can eat oil and grow, are they a sort of bacteria that can thrive in space?
Exactly right. And actually, we got our kind of starter kit from a compost pile in Hancock, Michigan. So it was all natural to begin with. The conditions that they grow well in are actually occur in a bioreactor. And conventionally, bioreactors are extremely expensive, but we made an open source one. So a normal bioreactor like that you'd have in a science lab is maybe $250,000, like roughly the price of a, you know, small house. Now, the bioreactors that we make are under $1,000, and we've shown that they can outperform the scientific ones by tweaking them. So we have extreme flexibility on controlling the environment that the bacteria are growing in. And we did that kind of for the original process for DARPA. And now those same bioreactors everybody can use for everything. And so the concept would be you'd land on an asteroid, you'd pulverize it, bring it inside part of a spaceship that had a controlled environment, that was basically a giant bioreactor, and grow your bacterial slurry there. And it would be a continuous process. So you'd constantly be feeding in more carbon and constantly be extracting yogurt, let's say.
Wow. That is kind of cool, I got to say. I mean, that's essentially finding a way to eat in space when there's no signs of life. I mean, hopefully, you know, you come across a few aliens, you could kill them and roast them. You know, I mean, that would be much, much better, one would presume, but...
Hopefully we don't start there with our first alien encounter, but our right now, to do deep space travel, we essentially are going to be sending robots. And if we want humans to kind of be part of it, like in Star Trek or anything like that, we need a way to provide food for the humans. Growing food in space has proven reasonably challenging. And, you know, when you start thinking about how many meals do you need per day, per year, you know, if it's going to take you 20 years to get somewhere, that's an enormous amount of weight, enormous cost. And so this would be a way that you could kind of refuel as you went. You just hop from asteroid to asteroid, the further out that you got. The next step is to try this out for real and try to do this for an actual military base. And if that works, then other applications like space or the developing world become very viable.
I'm really glad we chatted. That's fascinating research. And thank you so much for talking to me about it. Good luck with the work. I would suggest invest in some flavorings, you know, get some taco sauce in options for this bacteria to make it more palatable. Dr. Joshua Pierce from Western University in Ontario. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
I have to say, I love that. Although the idea of eating bacteria for years on a space mission, it couldn't get more dystopian future than that, could it? Some of your comments from last week, we were talking about rewilding, and we had Dr. Johnny Hansen from Queen's University on about whether or not we should be reintroducing things like lynx or wolves or even bears to Irish wildscapes. Louise says, would there be enough habitat that's suitable for these animals to be reintroduced? At the moment, no, but I think they do need more forest cover for something like wolves and lynx, because they'd be too exposed and wouldn't be very comfortable, I think, being so out in the open. Wolves being a very, very cautious and nervous creature, probably because we nearly hunted them to extinction. So understandable, I suppose. Another says, how much would it regress our ecosystem to now to reintroduce large predators that are no longer in the ecosystem? Well, so if you know, there's Owen Dalton, who is an author and big into this idea of rewilding Ireland. I fully am on board with what he's selling, to be honest. He was saying that, you know, that all you need to do is basically ward off a patch of land and let it be, and it will rewild itself pretty quickly. And you'll see biodiversity really, really quickly because it's not being grazed by sheep and invasive deer and all these sort of species that actually just raise everything to the ground and have created the sort of environment that we have. And we drive by and we see these really featureless landscapes around, and we think, oh, you know, this is what Ireland looks like. You know, he says, what, when we look out the window on a drive in the country, it's an absolutely ecological disaster because we farmed and raised the ground almost to nothing. And there's so little of this country that is natural forest habitat left anymore that it is an ecological disaster. So introducing these predators would reduce the amount of these animals free to roam and graze around. And the idea is introducing an apex predator restores a sense of a balance here. And, you know, if you listen back to the podcast, you'll hear what Johnny has to say about the work done in Yellowstone when they reintroduce wolves and whether or not it's as successful as hype makes out. But there's a number of different factors, but having an apex predator is seen to be important to rewild an area sufficiently to allow the circle of life. That's my take on it anyway. If you have another one yourself, you can email us science@newstalk.com. And that's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galva, Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker with a website that fits your unique vision and drives you towards your goals. Let your ideas flow with AI tools that guide you, but give you full control and flexibility. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. Get everything you need to turn your part-time passion into a full-time business. Go to Wix.com.